Hello, everybody. Welcome back. This is Julie Knudsen with the podcast Turning the Pointing Labrador and episode number 70. Been a little bit busy lately, so I guess it's been about 2 weeks or so. I hope not too much more since the last one, and I'm sorry about that. It's summer, the days are long, and there's lots of stuff going on. So I'm trying to get to these as quickly as I can. And so this episode, I'm going to try and put some things together. I'm going to answer some more questions that I've gotten because people have questions that are going to be relating to the upcoming season. So I can't wait too long on those. And then I'm going to talk a little bit more about the plan, you know, more on the plan for getting your 4X Grandmaster Pointing Retriever. And there's some other topics, single topics that I need to get to. But I'm going to do the best I can to try and get this stuff going. So I am going to go over some of the listener questions first to get those out of the way, because I know people are waiting so patiently. So I'm going to go with the first question, and it's a puppy question. So we'll start with the little guys first. Hello, Julie. I'll be receiving my first lab pup in a few months, and I've been studying your book and listening to your podcast. Thank you. I'm glad. Enjoying the information. Thankful you've taken the time to share your knowledge. I'm not sure everybody feels that way about it, but thank you. Okay, in listening to the puppy podcast, there's a piece of information I feel I've missed and would be so grateful for a reply. When the pup is on a leash and sitting next to you and you're ready to walk forward, is there a verbal command to release the pup from sitting and to start walking with you, such as the dog's name, or do you simply move forward and say heel? Thank you so much for your time to respond, and please know the time and effort you devote to your podcast. Deeply appreciated. Thank you. I do appreciate that very much. It's nice to hear. So, I guess I haven't made that clear, or at least I thought I did, but the word heel means be at my side, left side, right side, whichever side you've chosen. So heel means to do that. You don't, sit means to drop your bottom. So very simply, that's what it needs to mean in the dog's mind. So if you are going, you're motionless, the dog's sitting next to you, and you're going to take off and start walking, and you want the dog to be at your side, then you give the puppy the command for being at your side. So if you say heel and you start moving, that means stay at my side. So that is the cue for the dog to move with you. So that means forwards. For a puppy, that's all you want to do. Later on, you can move backwards. You can turn circles. If the dog's 10 feet away from you and you say heel, that means come over to your assigned side and sit down. So no, you don't say the dog's name, because the dog's name is what a lot of people use it for, is to get their attention. I don't. I need to already have their attention. Retrievers, you know, that's what conventionally you send them on a retrieve. That means go get it. So that would be very confusing in conventional retriever training. So when you want the dog to move with you, then you tell them heel, which means be at my side way, and have them remain in place. Then you would, as you moved away, give them the sit command so they knew that they weren't supposed to move with you. And if you're very consistent and pay attention to the detail and the timing of that, your dog will become very, very clear and will respond to the word that you say and understand exactly what it is. So I hope that answers that question. Heel means be at this side of me. And so no matter what you do when you say that, they need to do whatever it takes to be at your side on that. So let me see. We had another one from an old friend of mine that was on here. And this question was, hey, listening to another podcast. Really enjoy those. You know, the flattery works really good, you guys. So thank you. You were just talking about swim by and saying it's not about right cast or left cast, but going into the water or towards the bank. Can you elaborate on that a little? And actually, you know, that should be an entire podcast, the swim by. The swim by is the process through which a dog is taught what the behavioral standards are in the water for while retrieving, whether marks or blinds or whatever. So that's where you, one, develop the tools you have to teach the dog the things that you need it to do. Now, it's also called water force because there is an element of water force in that. But it is the place where you acquire all the tools to be able to manage and communicate to your dog in the water in a way that the dog understands. That's what it's really all about. So if you get on YouTube or you look at a lot of the things, when you watch people do, they have, some people have the white buckets and the white this, and they have things marked, and everybody has this stuff that they have, and you aim the dog at the white thing, and you teach him to go here. Lots and lots of stuff that can be a little bit confusing, but a lot of stuff. It's not confusing to people, but it can be really confusing to the dogs. So you get all this different stuff. And so when you're trying to understand really what the Swimbai is, it can be a little daunting until you see it done well and repeatedly and see what the result is in the understanding and the behavior of the dog. So after you have forced a dog on land, where they know that when you say back, they must go, and that when you blow the sit whistle, they must stop. And then that when you once again cast or give the back command, they must go. All right, when you have, and in the kind of the more modern deal, that's the double T. It's a Rex car thing that's been developed for a long time. There's variations on it. But that's where you clearly set up in the dog's mind that when you say back or cast them, that they must move to the back. Not over stuff. You cannot do, there's no forcing on overs. That's just a non sequitur in a dog's mind. But when I say back, you go, and you stop when I blow the whistle, and then you go again. There is no forcing. There's no electricity on overs. And if anybody's ever told you that, you need to go to another source, right? You can force them to go away from you, but you can't force them to go at a certain angle to you. It makes no sense because dogs don't do geometry. Which brings me to the water thing. So once you have the tools of you got to go and you got to stop on land, then you have to teach them in water. Ideally, you have a rectangular pond. Sometimes you have to use the one cove, a little cove in a lake, and you do it from one side to get one direction, and you go to the other side to do the other direction. And so you have your rectangular pond, and you begin by teaching the dog, and this, you're not going the long ways, all right? You're going across. You teach the dog, you have to go into the water, across, out, pick up some bumpers, get back into the water and come straight back. There's no running around. So that's the first thing you do is you got to go straight across and straight back. You can do that with a rope. If you have a dog that isn't going to require a rope so that you don't have to pull them back into the water, then you go ahead and you can do it without that. But that's first thing you do is teach. I'm pointing you directly at a very clear picture of water. It's a very clear picture. And there are a bunch of white bumpers just on the other side. So you go straight over there and straight back. So in the dog's mind, what you're getting then is I'm pointed at water. I see directly dead center where I need to go across there. And then you teach them right, and then you come straight back. So you don't do anything else until you are pointed at water. You teach them, get in, go across, come straight back. So some dogs, that's easy. Others, once they get across, they want to run around, which you can't let them do. So you either have to handle them or you have to use the rope. And that's not, maybe I can do a podcast on this stuff, but they have to come straight back. So then you get them where they go across, straight back, and they understand. You point me at the water, whether my back is to the water and I'm facing you and you give me a right or left back cast, I have to turn and dive directly into the water, go across, come back. That's what it is in the dog's mind. Boy, there's water. Just dive at it. Right? They're not thinking angles or any of that kind of stuff. Or if they're at your side and you put your hand down and say back and they're pointed at the center of that water, they got to jump into the center of that water, swim across, pick up what's over there, jump back into the center of that thing and come straight back. So that's step one in this series, all right, is they can't just run 10 feet down, whoop, jump across, get over, pick it up, go 10 feet back, pick it up, go 10 feet. They need to make a direct effort to go right at the water, get out, pick it up, go right at the water coming back. So part of your swim by is establishing that sense of urgency about getting in the water and getting back in the water. You don't progress until you have that. So once you do, okay, now you start stopping the dog, right? First we got to stop, which means, and that's generally requires a rope. You know, some dogs are pretty easy and it doesn't take much, if any of that, but other dogs, you got to have a rope because they're like, you know, you forced me across, nothing's stopping me, I'm going to go. Just kind of like they do on the tee. So you have the rope so that when you tweet and blow that whistle, they have to turn around. Now there's a lot of stuff they do there, but that's not the point of this question. Sometimes they start coming back, they get panicky, they won't stop, all kinds of stuff. But you teach them to stop and then look at you. And it's not a time thing. It's not like 3, 2, 1, cast, go. They have to turn around and look at you, wait until you give the cast, and then take it. And you have the rope. So now we've taught them, when I point you at the water, you get into the middle of it. And when you get out, you get back into the middle of it. And if I stop you, right, then you stop and wait to see what happens. So now to get to the question about casting left or right. So this is in a rectangular pond, or basically something that's longer than it is wide across. It's longer. So there's more water to the sides than there is back or front. Okay, there's more water to the sides. That's why when you go to professionals, everybody has a swim by pond. It's rectangular. It's longer than it is wide across. Now, after you've got where the dog will stop, turn around, wait, take a right back or a left back, you're going to start teaching the overs. And it's not that you're teaching over so much, but you've already taught over the overcast on land, so they know when you put your hand out at a 90 degree to the right or left, that means, you know, you go take a 90 degree, roughly, they don't think 90 degree, but you go the same direction as that hand over to pick up a bumper. Now what we're doing is we're teaching the dog, all right, I'm going to stop you. And now, and there's a lot of ways you get them to do this, that's not what this is about, I'm going to cast you towards more water. And you are going to stay in the water to the very, very end of it, as far as you can go. And then you pick up something on that end, and then you get back in and swim all the way across. In other words, swim by. You have to teach this. They don't do it right off. Usually you got to run down to the other side after they picked up the bumper, so you get them to go swim all the way the longest length of the water to the other end. Now, the reason you're doing that, and you get to do it right and left and all that, is to teach them, I just stopped you from going one direction in the water, and now you are going to seek a whole bunch more water. You are going to seek more water, because if you've ever been in a pond swimming, when you're down there at eye level, you don't see any geometry at all. You don't see rectangular pond. You don't see technical pond. You don't see points, peninsulas, angles, coves. You see none of that. Just if you haven't, get down in a pond and look. So you just see water and land. That's all you see. So the best we can ask of these guys is you point them in the direction of the maximum amount of water and teach them that's what you do. Ultimately, after you get this, then you teach channel blinds, right? Here's a big long thing. You stay in the water all the way to the end. So even though people are, and they say over and all this stuff, and they're putting out a left hand or a right hand, what you're doing in the mind of that dog that's not seeing the same picture you see at 6 feet in the air or 5.5 feet in the air or whatever it is, you're telling them, no, stay in the water and take a lot of water, right or left or whatever. And so basically in the mind of the dog, the command, the hands up and down are a seek water thing, not a geometry thing. Because you can't do geometry at eye level in a pond very well, but you certainly can stay in water as much as you can. So I hope that answers that question, but that's what it is. And if you watch the dogs and think about it, I mean, that's why when you see dogs right out of swim by, a lot of times they won't even get out. They will, they'll follow the edge. They'll find more water. They'll do anything they can, you know, cause I got to stay in the water. And as long as it's not out of, you know, abject fear or something, that's a good job on those swim by, cause you're teaching the dog seek water. And then if you get out and I put a hand towards water, that means jump right back in. So that's kind of, that's what that one means. I hope that, I hope that answers that. Cause that's a good question. The swim by, what people do in that is amazing to me. So I hope that people kind of get that one. Now, let me see. I have another question. I got to find it on here. Just a second. I lost this one and then I had it up again. Okay. So here's my next one. This is one that might be interesting to some folks. All right. It's kind of a lengthy question, but I think this might relate to a lot of people. I just finished listening to podcast 68 and 69, preparing for the 4X training program, and I had a question about the amount of upland training you mentioned in podcast 68. You said once a week is a balanced amount of training with live birds with the rest of your time on retriever work. I assume you're referring to raised game birds. I've been doing it about once a month. Training with my club and attending hunt tests. I notice a lot of dogs point real close or even stand over the bird. It doesn't seem these dogs get very much exposure to wild birds. And when the conditions are bad, too warm or no wind, this results in many dogs catching the bird at the test and they're disqualified. That's all true. Just like you mentioned in your book, wild birds have taught my dog not to pressure them. I lost a lot of birds in the beginning and wouldn't shoot or chase after them. My concern is that now that my dog has been hunting mostly wild birds, you lucky guy, the last couple of seasons, if I put her on too many training birds, that it's possible she'll start crowding and pointing close and possibly start catching birds. She steadied a wing and shot and well trained, not totally over the ridge well trained, still working on that. Well, get that. That'll help too. Is that something to worry about, or should I just keep once a month upland training program? I assume if you're talking about your upland once a month, you're talking about wild birds. Wild birds are fantastic. That's the best kind of bird there is. You might want to, before you run the pointing lab test, make sure that your dog is familiar with planted birds. Now, just because the people you train with plant birds, there's nothing like a wild bird, all right? Because there's no human scent. They're going to move. The dog has to be extremely, extremely good. But you don't always have that. So because you're going to be competing on planted birds, both of you and your dog need to be familiar with the human scent thing and the way, you know, depending on who's judging and how they like things, how these birds are going to be put down. There's some judges that they're just going to have the planters go out there and kind of drop them in some stuff. So they'll be moving around and others that are going to be in, you know, basically hermetically sealed into a giant unnatural pile of something and they can't move. I hope not. I think that where you are, probably people are going to be getting judges that won't necessarily do that. But you do have to have your dog familiar with what you're going to be competing with. So if you want to use pen-raised birds, if you have some available, been very difficult this year for a lot of people, including me, then go put them somewhere in some low cover where they're not stuck, where they can move. When you get back there with your dog, they're not in the same spot. But if you have the right kind of cover, alfalfa is my favorite for that one. They got a scent really well, but those birds don't want to fly out of that, and they move through there. And so you have to, just like somewhat like a wild bird, you know, that bird, you've got to find a bird that you're not sure where it is, and the bird can move. So before you get ready to compete, you should have your dog understanding what that is. And, you know, that birds, I wouldn't stick them hard, because if you stick a bird hard, particularly if you over-dizzy it and it's kind of, you know, not doing very well, they're supposed to go pick those up. If you're hunting and you kind of wound a bird, they're supposed to go get them. So if they go in there and a bird isn't doing very well and they pick it up, you fail the test. But you can't blame a wild bird hunting dog for that, because it's like, something's wrong with this one, I better get it. So don't train on catchable birds. Don't train on birds that can't move, so your dog learns, hey, you just get really close. You're absolutely right. Your planting of the birds can be something that you can use to your advantage. So there's just some common sense stuff in that. But I would definitely do that. And I would do it a number of times until you were fairly comfortable with what your dog was going to do with all the scent and kind of the artificial situation. If you're talking about getting titles, we're talking about doing what it takes to get the titles. So yeah, go until you feel, until the dog is consistent, understands, and you're comfortable with it. And by that time, it's just about going to be test time. So I hope that answers that question. I have some more, but not maybe quite as, haven't been waited as long or as related to stuff. So I hope that helps those things. There's just an awful lot to this stuff. All right, more on the training for your 4X title. So we talked about kind of breaking things down, basically characterizing, you know, where you are with your dog, you know, where the skill level is best and where the skill level is not best. And so we're going to proceed from there. But one of the most important aspects is you the dog handler, the person training and running the dog. Because having watched these things since the very, very beginning when it first started, judging and certainly running a ton, you are very often at the master level when you're watching what happens, assuming the dog is reasonably trained, which they do need to be, you know, they do need to understand and be prepared for whatever test it is. I would say half or more of the time when I see people fail, it's not the dog. It is the handler who unwittingly, unintentionally made a mistake or a series of mistakes that wound up doing them in. And so I wish that there's all kind of things about training the dogs, but we really need a people training thing on this. Just because it's just amazing, the mistakes. And I can't sit here and I can't even remember and list all of the things, but I think it's really important if you're going to go run your dog at this level, even if you have a lot before, because I've seen people that have done it a lot make the same mistake over and over again and always blame the darn dog, or better yet, the terrible judges, right? A terrible test. Judges are out to get me. They don't like me. They're stupid. You know, there's just every reason in the world. So I would say, and I've said this before, the best medicine for poor judging, poor test setups, poor birds, poor conditions is really good preparation and a dog that knows what it's doing and a handler. That's the best thing you can do to counter stuff that's going to happen that's not your doing, that's not your fault. So you can't, you know, if you just have a set of bad judges or the conditions just got really bad, or, you know, you just had a bad break, that stuff happens. But it's amazing how much better the judging and the tests get, the better your dog is. It's just amazing how that works. So let's talk about, let's say you got the worst set of judges in the worst place in the world. Now, how do we go past those kind of tests? So let's just talk about you, the handler, right now. Let's leave the dog out. We've already been analyzing the dog and how well they mark and how well, what their handling is like. And, you know, are they pointing or not? Are they holding point? You know, do they point like we were just in the prior question, you know, standing over the bird, or do they not? Are they further back in a safer, you know, more realistic position? So we've been kind of characterizing that, and we have to address those things. But let's talk about the person running this dog, because it's easy to not take that into account. So people get very nervous, and even really experienced, there's pros that you see you know, they have their 22-hole fancy trailer and they do this. I'm nervous, so nervous, if you knew how nervous they were. You know, it's amazing. People, everybody, new people get really nervous, not new people get really nervous. So whatever level of that you bring into this, why don't you lay that out? Let's get another sheet of paper out and talk about how you are on game day. Because that's probably one of the single biggest factors that's going to help you or hurt you. How are you on game day? And right now is the time, months before we start the testing again, now is the time to do this and start trying to change a few things that might be helpful to you. So how nervous do you get? Are you one of the people when you get nervous, all of a sudden you can't, you know, the thinking just goes away? Even though you know exactly what you should do when your dog is doing this and that, it's just your head is empty. I think a lot of people can relate to that. One of the first times I won a qualifying in a field trial a million years ago, and my little dog, it's a great little dog, and I didn't know it. I was going to win this thing, and I was running the water blind, and you know, they called me to the line, and I was still going in the third series. You know, it's the first time I'd ever done this, and I can remember my heart was beating so loud I couldn't hear my own whistle. I couldn't hear what, you know, I could hear nothing. I was just so, I was like, oh my God, I'm in the third series of a field trial. And fortunately I could continue to function. That helps because I've competed my whole life in all kinds of things, but I know what that's like to stand up there and all of a sudden you're not you. And it's a very difficult, kind of a situation to be in. So what do you do? And if you don't know what you do, and hearken back, you know, what you do in the spelling bee in high school or grade school or the basketball finals, you know, how are you at crunch time? And just because you're an ER physician and you know, they can bring the worst trauma case in the world to you and you can in a dime, you know exactly what to do, does not mean you can do the same thing over in this dog running thing. If you don't have the experience and the conditioning you do in what it is you are pro in. So, you know, this is different than your other regular life where you are a professional at it. So unless you are a professional at this, you know, you probably have good reason to be a little bit nervous. So you need to really get a hold of that. And if you do get really nervous, let's just say being nervous in front of everybody. So here's the answer everybody has. You need to go do hunt test setups. You need, and to a degree, that's true. Maybe if you had a training group with a lot of people, but then you know most of them, and if you make a big mistake, it's not a big deal because you're not wasting your $155 entry fee. So that's something that's not a bad thing to do. But I think that you have to dig down and find some ways to put yourself in a very in a position in which you're not comfortable. So hanging out with the same people, doing the same stuff in the same place, does not help you if you are really the nervous type. If you're nervous, let's say you're getting ready to run pointing lab tests, go run some other stuff if you can. If you can, you know, I know that's kind of expensive, but if you can go run some other hunt tests, some HRC or some AKC stuff, go over there and run that stuff. You know, get nervous over there. Learn what you know, what it's like to stand on the line. Learn what it's like to, you know, have judges control everything you do. Learn what it's like to stand there with, you know, having to follow all the rules and think about them. So that's one place. Go run some other things. Or go, when you're doing your training things, run them by the strictest rules out there. For example, in the American Pointing Lab Association, you're allowed to speak quietly to your dog. So if you always do that all the time and you're comfortable speaking a lot, then stop. You know, you do it like the AKC where you can't speak after you signal for birds. Find ways to make it more difficult and more challenging. One of the things an old guy that from a long time ago used to do for people to get them ready to go run some big dog events was he would get one of those big, like a big boom box thing, and put it on some like heavy metal kind of, you know, now the dogs don't like that. Be careful about getting the dogs kind of screwed up. But play this booming music right behind you, like in a chair right behind you. Holy cow, that was hard to function and think about stuff like that while that was going on. But when you could do that, you had acquired some abilities to function under a very difficult situation. So you can think of things like that to do that will get you used to functioning under duress, functioning when it's hard to think. And so the nervous thing is a big aspect, because if you don't think quickly enough, you'll miss the right choice about whether to handle or not. You know, should I handle? If I should, when should I handle? Out in the upland field, there's a zillion ways to mess that stuff up. So you have to be able to think about things real quickly. And if it's too late, you know, there comes your dog with the bird. So and then you're out. So do some things in your training. Begin to do this and go ahead and escalate them quite a bit. It doesn't matter if people think you're nuts. I mean, who cares? You're trying to go get the 4X thing. If they think you're nuts, that's fine. Just hold all those purple ribbons at them later. But find some ways to challenge you without screwing up your dog. Challenge you to think when it's difficult to think. And again, get creative. Like I said, have horns honking. Have the radio blaring. You know, have it be somewhere where it's really hard to hear and just stuff like that. Just, or people that you don't like, train with them. So you're real uncomfortable, but you've got to begin to learn to function, because, you know, there's people I probably listen to this podcast who have had some experiences this year where they didn't think of something quick enough. They just defaulted to some old behavior and it made them go out. And with a good dog that was well-trained, but because they couldn't think quick enough, or they just do what they always did in relaxed and comfortable training, and it was too late. And so that happens a great, great deal of the time. And I want to talk about, that's marks and blinds, and it's also now in the upland field. Don't train in the upland field with heavy metal or whatever music they would have now that's real annoying. Just clanging in the background, because you need the dog bird thing to go on. But, and I'm going to give an example. Some people that are listening to this know what I'm talking about. We had a test this spring. There was a giant set of cattails in the middle of this big field. Giant set of cattails. High winds. I don't know, everywhere from 20 to 50 miles an hour. Really high wind. Very difficult situation. But they were putting birds. They weren't planting them very, I think they planted a couple on the edges of the cattails often, but mostly they were outside of that, because that's not real good for upland birds to put birds in the cattails. But all the birds that would fly up or whatever, you know where they all went. They all went right into those cattails. So you have this big old stand of cattails, dry cattails, in the middle of the master upland field, and high winds. So you know what happened, right? All the scent, there's a ton of scent coming out of the cattails. And there's a bunch of birds in the cattails. So where do the dogs want to go? Into the cattails. And so you would see, people would get, some people just let their dogs go in there. And then they'd come out with one of the birds, which is a fail. Or they would try really hard to keep their dog out of the cattails, but the dog was not as responsive to what they asked as they probably hoped. And eventually, or they couldn't find birds, or maybe the scent from the cattails was stronger than the scent of a single bird farther away. But anyway, their dogs wound up back in the cattails, and it never ended well for anybody's dogs that were in there. So, one, you should have enough control over your dog that you can keep them out of a dangerous place, and right, easier said than done. And then the other thing is, don't go near there. Be aware of some hazards. And when you're new, it's hard to know. But if you've upland hunted, you kind of know what birds do, and you kind of know what happens in that situation. So watch everybody run in front of you that you can, and watch what's happening, and then make some plans. Now, one of the truisms of the APLA Master Upland Field And anybody listening to this that's done it will know exactly what I'm talking about. But you stand up on the hill or over to the side and you watch everybody go through the field and you see all their mistakes. You see all of them. Oh, man, I wouldn't go over there. Well, that's stupid. Well, look, they have not even gotten that whole quadrant on that side until you get out there. And then when you get out there, you don't see any of the stuff you saw just calmly standing on the side watching. You don't know if you've already been over there or not. Everything looks different. So don't, when you're real judgmental of how well people are doing, you know, you'll quit doing that after you're out there a bunch of times going, I don't know where I've been. I'm lost. When the wind shifted, I don't know what to do. It can be really hard. Know that. You can have the best plan in the world. And then when you get out there, you're going, holy crap, I don't know where I am. I thought I was up on the hill, but this is not it. So, you know, stuff happens. So watch everybody in front of you. Do the best you can. Don't sit there and criticize them till you're all done. And make a plan. And then know that when you get out there, it's not the same. It's just not the same. So, you know, practice in places where you get used to that. Where you don't, if you just do the same field all the time, you train in the same place. So you know where every little weed and thorn bush is. And then you're going to be hurting when you're in a field you've never been in before, never seen before. So you and your dog need to be used to brand new places that you're not familiar with. So that you learn how to adjust when you're not sure what's happening. All right, I'm not sure where I've been. So what's the wind direction? What can I do now to make this work for me? You know, and sometimes the wind shifts. And sometimes it shifts a lot. So you've got to be able to go, oh, this is not what my plan was. But now it's coming out of the west. So I think I'm going to go here on this east side and see if I can't, you know, make this work better for me. So all kinds of funny stuff like that happens. And it really helps if you know that could happen and that you've run some stuff through your mind to prepare. Oh, what if this all goes to heck? You know, gee, what would I do? And be careful about watching Joe Pro go out in front of you and run the field a certain way and then go, all right, that's what I'll do. I mean, that may be exactly the right thing to do. But if you have no thoughts of your own, if you're not going to fall back on what you and your dog have done in training for a long, long time, that's a little bit dangerous. So if that's the best way to go and it works with what you do, then do it. But if it doesn't, you know, I've watched people that are famous, you know, go out there and do stuff. And I'm just thinking, I'm not going to run the field that way. I'm just not comfortable with it. And I do my own thing. And because I've, you know, done it a lot with the dogs, it usually works for me. So don't be afraid to do your thing out there. Make sure it's just based on having done it a lot with your dog and feeling pretty comfortable with what your dog's going to do. So instead of judging the grounds, and I'm just going to say this early because I don't want to keep harping on this as we get into the more technical stuff. When you drive up to the test and go, this is no good. Look at that's dry. That I wouldn't use that field. I'd use this field. Oh, I don't like that. I wouldn't plant the birds that way. I'd do this. When you fall into that talk and that kind of perspective, that's the worst karma you could have. I guarantee you. It may not be as well done as well as you would do it. It may not be set up as well as you would set it up. It might not be anything you like or have ever seen before. But don't fixate on that. Instead, go, all right, we're going to go run a set of marks and blinds and land and set on water. My dog is trained. They know when I point them at water because I did swim by so well that I get in and I stay in until whatever. Go in with that kind of preparation. Know that your dog knows how to find birds. Wild birds, awesome. Birds that aren't that wild still knows all the same rules apply. Never learned that you can just go in and grab stuff because it just sits there half dead or buried. Get prepared that way. And then go out there and believe a little bit in your dog and be ready because something's going to happen. Something's going to be funny. Something's not going to be the way it's supposed to be, but you already knew that. So when it happens, go, well, there it is. All right, let me see. What am I going to do? I think if you got to reel your dog in, you know, for a second to just gather your thoughts about something, nowhere in the rules of this says you can't do that. Just let the judges know, you know, what you're doing. And try and make this be as unnerve-wracking and as under your control as it can be. And it won't always be. So really get a hold of yourself and your ability to deal with difficult, changing, sudden, or abrupt situations. And safety always is first. Always your dog's safety is first. Always your safety is first. You'll never get in trouble if your dog's overheating to say, my dog is overheating, I have to stop. Never sacrifice your dog. You know, never let somebody shoot, you know, in a way that's harmful to you or your dog. Always, that's always the most important thing. In the long haul, it really is. So get a hold of those situations. Get a hold of the good question I had about, you know, hen-raised birds versus wild birds. Get the situation, manage it, wild or best, use some pen raise so your dog knows about that, and knows how they smell, and knows that, you know, you can track people right to them, and doesn't all of a sudden equate that with, well, that means I can run in and get it. You got to teach that stuff. So make a plan for unexpected things, make a plan for, you know, how you're going to best be prepared regardless of the situation. And I'll say it again. The best medicine for poor judging or poor tests is a good, well-trained dog that's handled well. That's the best medicine for that. Your griping will drop dramatically when you're ready for the test. And you're not going to blame a Tweety bird that flew by or a noise that somebody made or, well, this guy doesn't like me and he set this up because he knew I wouldn't be able to do it. If you can get rid of all that baloney and just do a really good job, it's a lot more fun when you do that kind of stuff. Okay? So, again, I'm not that much into specifics. I hope the swim by question helped, because you definitely want dogs with the right perspective about things and to develop the right tools and not to get into a lot of the YouTube stuff that you'll see where it's like, all right, get a white bucket, put it over here, and it, you know, and we're not dealing with teaching the dog a sense of urgency about what their job is, but instead teaching some dance step that they have to do. You know, dance steps just aren't going to cut it on a really tough day when things are going all funny. So I hope that helps on that. I think on the next one, maybe I can get all these questions answered and then I don't have to do one on that. We're going to talk about some upland preparation related to the question we had. You know, how do you really, really prepare for this to be successful? Because it's sort of a moving target depending on where your dog is, and very much a moving target depending on where you are in your understanding of all this stuff. This is, like I said, of all the dog things I've done, and I've won opens, and I've won derbies and qualifyings, never run an amateur in my life in a field trial, right? And I've done all the hunt test stuff there is to do, but on a given day, the hardest thing I've ever done with dogs is this whole master deal. Marks, blinds, and then upland. So many aspects, so many things that could go wrong, so many things to be on top of. So trying to get everybody kind of clarified in little pieces, just like I would a dog if I were training it, getting all the little pieces put together so that on game day, they all come together really nicely. But on this one, if you take nothing away from this, is you are a huge factor. One mistake, and it's up. Your dog can make a few mistakes, and if you're good, you can address that and keep going or prevent them from making mistakes. But you're the one that's got to either blow the whistle or not blow the whistle at the right time, give the right cast, understand what the dog is thinking, know when they're getting near a bird that's going to be a difficult problem for them, know how to approach, you know, the area where you think birds are planted. There's a whole lot to that. So I'm going to try and dedicate one of these to some thoughts on the upland part of this. But in the meantime, it's really hot in a lot of places. So if you are doing your upland, do it, you know, late evening or early morning. The humidity is a major factor in whether they can smell or not smell, the breeze. Remember, if it's 3 inches off the ground in thick stuff, there's probably no wind. No breeze for the dog, so they've got to get closer There's so many things to think about on this stuff. So be a real good observer. Pay a lot of attention. Don't overheat your dog. When their tongue is hanging out, there is no air going into the nose part, which talks to the brain part about what's there. So when that tongue's hanging out, the air's going right into the lungs, and they're not able to smell an ostrich standing in front of them. So be very, very careful of the wind and all of this stuff. And keep on, you know, just start with the basics and keep things real simple. And I will be back, I hope, very, very soon, and keep on this four-time program.